The Exchange Podcast is brought to you in part by the University System of New Hampshire in partnership with its four institutions around the state. Visit usnh.edu/yours to learn what you can accomplish here.
The Exchange Podcast also gets support from the New Hampshire Chiropractic Association, an organization of professionals providing a non-invasive, non-surgical approach to healthcare, tailoring treatment plans to meet individuals' needs. Learn more at nhchiropractic.org.
From NHPR, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. After last summer's protests over systemic racism and policing, the state legislature took up bills on body cameras, more data collection, and officer misconduct. So, where do those efforts stand? Also, beginning June 19th, Governor Chris Sununu says he's ending the weekly enhanced unemployment benefit of $300 per week. And how has the state Supreme Court's ruling on ER boarding impacted the state budget? These and other stories made headlines this week, and we're glad you're with us for our chat about them today. To join the conversation, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also use Facebook, tweet us, or send us an email. Our email address is exchange@nhpr.org. With us for this part of the program, Ali Pham, NHPR's health and equity reporter. Ali, thank you very much for being here. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, great to be here with you, Peter.
So let's talk about that enhanced unemployment benefit that's going to be ending. Governor Sununu announced this week that beginning June 19th, he would end that weekly enhanced unemployment benefit that was set up for COVID-19 related relief. Can you talk a little bit about what exactly these benefits are, where they come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So Governor Sununu said that he is ending all federal pandemic unemployment benefits flowing into New Hampshire. And that, you know, includes that $300 weekly enhanced benefit that you just mentioned. And that's a benefit that is going to all folks in New Hampshire who are collecting unemployment insurance right now. So people who are on federal and state programs are getting that $300 weekly benefit. But I want to point out there's also thousands of people who are going to lose their benefits completely because they're only collecting benefits on federal programs. And that includes gig workers and self-employed people who are collecting benefits on just a federal program. And that also includes people who have been collecting benefits for longer than the state usually allows. So they're on kind of a federal extension program. And so those folks are going to lose their unemployment insurance completely. The only people who are still going to be collecting unemployment insurance after June 19th are people who are on regular state benefits.
Okay. And what did Governor Sununu say was his reason for cutting off the stream of benefits on June 19th?
Right. So, I mean, his reasoning is he wants to get people back to work. And we do have a bit of a labor shortage here in the state. There's a lot of open jobs. And I also want to say, you know, Governor Sununu is one of many Republican governors to kind of have this line of reasoning and also to make this decision to cut the stream of federal benefits into the state. But that question of are these benefits the thing that is stopping people from going back to work? I mean, that's very, you know, study after study has looked at this and it's, you know, they found that this is not the main thing that's keeping people from working. There are so many other factors at play here. And, you know, folks in New Hampshire right now who are collecting unemployment insurance, they are looking for work because the work requirement is kicking back in. So, you know, I think pulling these benefits, it might force some people back into the labor force. However, is it worth the trade-off of also, you know, pulling what has been a very, very crucial social safety net for a lot of people out from under them? You know, I think that's the question here. And, you know, there's also an economic argument that these benefits are actually going back into the economy. I mean, for a lot of folks, you know, they're not sticking these benefits in a savings account and just sitting on them. They're using them to pay their bills. They're using them to pay their rent. They're using them to buy groceries or diapers. So, I mean, you know, in some ways, the benefits are going to businesses.
Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, Ali, if it's what are the factors preventing people from going back to work? You mentioned that there were some studies saying that the unemployment benefits aren't necessarily the things preventing people.
Right. Absolutely. So for some people, it's still COVID. I spoke to a woman named Mindy Gibson. She's in Rochester, and Mindy's immunosuppressed. So her doctor says that right now she still shouldn't be working in person. And it's not that Mindy isn't looking for work. I want to make that clear. It's just that Mindy has some really specific needs. So she needs something that's remote, and she needs something that's flexible with her health conditions. And so finding a job like that, where you're looking for something specific, can, take some time. So, here's what Mindy told me when, what she felt like when she heard about the news that these benefits were being cut.
And I thought I had a couple of more months to find something that would fit. And he just yanked that rug right out from under. So now I don't know what next month will look like. And I may be packing again.
That's Mindy Gibson speaking to you, Ali Pham, earlier this week about the termination of the enhanced unemployment benefit of $300 per week. Listeners, we'd love to hear your story on this. Have you been receiving these enhanced benefits? And if so, what will the consequences be for you when it disappears? And also, since we've been talking about the things that may be preventing you from rejoining the labor force in a traditional way, what are those things for you? Let us know. 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. Ali Pham, who do you think is going to be disproportionately impacted by this policy change?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think people with health conditions that are still keeping them out of the workforce, like Mindy Gibson, for one. And I asked Governor Sununu about this at the press conference earlier this week, kind of what he, is thinking around folks who have, legitimate COVID-19 concerns about returning to work. And he said, they should get vaccinated. And he kind of threw it back to me and said, if they're not going to be returning to the workforce now, then when are they? And, I think for some people, that when is a few months down the road. I spoke to a woman named Kate Beanland, and she works with folks who have a disability, she's kind of driving them around, getting them to their doctor's appointment. And, she's kind of hoping that at a certain point, case rates are going to be lower than they are now. Community transmission is going to no longer be substantial, and vaccination rates are going to be higher. And that would be a time when maybe she can come back to the workforce in person. But, right now, that's not the case. And, another class of workers that I think are really kind of hit hard by this and kind of caught between a rock and a hard place are women who are juggling childcare issues. I spoke to a woman named Gabrielle Schuler, who's divorced, and she told me, when she's looking for jobs, she says, yes, there are a lot of jobs out there, but that it's really, really challenging to find something that is either high paying enough to afford childcare or flexible enough that allows her to still take care of her kids. And she told me about one interview in particular that she had where this issue of childcare and flexibility just became a real sticking point. And yeah, here's what she said.
I went to my second interview. And all the woman was concerned about was that I had children and what my backup plan was going to be because I was not going to be able to call out.
Yeah. So, and in addition to Gabrielle's experience, something I've heard from women across the state is that the pandemic has actually also made childcare harder to find than it was before. So some places that they used to send their kids to have either closed or are still kind of on a reduced capacity. So, the childcare crisis has deepened in this pandemic.
Yeah, it does sound like a tough situation to be in for sure. Ali Pham, the governor did announce that he would be giving people a stipend if they get a new job. Mm-hmm. What are the details of this plan?
Yeah, absolutely. So the governor announced a new $10 million program, and he says that will provide a bonus to folks who are currently unemployed who return to work for at least 8 consecutive weeks. And so people who are returning part-time will be eligible for a $500 bonus, and people who are returning full-time can apply for a $1,000 bonus. And that program is starting immediately. And it also to be clear, it's only available for people who are going to be making $25 an hour or less. So I think the governor is trying a lot of different things to get people back to work. It's kind of a mix of carrots and sticks. So here's kind of a small carrot, like, hey, come back to work, you can get this little bonus. And the stick being pulling federal benefits. And then, you know, there's also the work requirement is coming back as well.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, if you have a story you'd like to tell about enhanced unemployment benefits, receiving them, the consequences for what will happen to you when it disappears, give us a call now, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's go to the phones and talk to Johnny in Nashua. Johnny, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
I take it that I'm supposed to be Johnny?
The name's actually Tony.
Oh, no, that's quite all right. So what it comes down to, what I've noticed, is I've been looking at the job market over the last 2 years. I actually had been sick, so I'm trying to find something that I can do from home remotely. And what I have noticed is after a lot of people got laid off, the pay rate of what they're willing to pay people has actually gone down, where everyone's rents have gone up. I mean, we all know that the housing shortage and, you know, rental landlords are taking advantage of this, saying, oh, well, you know, it costs more. So everyone's rent has gone up, but the pay has gone down. So there's reasons that you don't take a job, because if it doesn't pay the bills, it doesn't pay the bills.
Well, Tony, thank you very much for your comments. Really appreciate it. Ali Pham, you've been talking to people about this unemployment situation. To what extent does housing and the cost of housing and maybe the difficulty of finding adequate housing come up? Does it come up in your conversations with people about unemployment?
Yeah, absolutely. It does. I think it's something that a lot of people have specifically said that they've actually been using these benefits to pay. They've been using them to pay their rent. And I think people are also nervous. If I lose my housing, where am I going to go? There's this housing crisis. I'm not going to be able to find something affordable. So definitely, I think this is a huge concern.
And to what extent are the folks you're speaking to taking advantage of the rental assistance programs that are available in the state?
Yeah. Actually, the woman I mentioned earlier, Mindy Gibson, she told me yesterday after we talked that she is applying for rental assistance. But in many cases, it's taking a while for those applications to get processed. So people are kind of still waiting there.
We got this note from Kevin who says, in all of this, the strangest thing to me is that people think the restaurants will be able to hire a lot of people once these benefits are removed. I've always heard that those jobs are low-paying and are, quote-unquote, for kids. Does New Hampshire really think the teenagers and young adults who do not pay for rent and housing are the ones who are getting unemployment? I mean, I don't think anyone can afford to support themselves on those wages regardless. That's the comment from Kevin. So with respect to unemployment, Ali, what will you be following in your reporting in the next week or so?
Yeah, I think I'm going to just kind of continue to talk to folks about their experiences. And I think just kind of monitoring like where the jobs are and where people's skills are. And I think there is that mismatch of a lot of these jobs are low paying and in the service sector, and people are, you know, often trying to return to the field that they lost their job in, which is not necessarily that sector and maybe paid more.
Got it. Okay. Well, let's switch gears a little bit, Ali, and talk about vaccination, because you've been doing some reporting on how the state is ending its distribution of vaccines at those big sites where lots of people could go to get vaccinations, and vaccines are kind of shifting into people's doctor's offices, right? Is that basically the long and short of it?
Absolutely. Yeah. The state is going to be basically phasing out their large fixed sites. So after Memorial Day, they're no longer going to be offering first shots at those state sites. And so, you know, as those sites phase out, they're bringing the vaccine further into that traditional healthcare space. So it's already been at pharmacies, it's already been at hospitals, but the goal now is to kind of get it into doctors' offices. And, you know, that transition, it turns out, is actually kind of tricky, because the COVID vaccine it's got some difficult storage issues. It's got some issues with multiple doses in a vial. So, you know, right now it's, the transition is just kind of happening in for primary care providers who are bigger and see more clients, and it's not yet just kind of going to be readily available at your doctor's office for a walk-in appointment or something like that.
Yeah, the storage thing is the first thing that strikes me about this, Allie, because early in the pandemic, when we were hearing about vaccines being transported all across the country, the concern was that they would be able to be kept cold enough to sort of stand up to travel. Now, do doctor's offices in New Hampshire, by and large, have the kind of refrigeration units that can keep it at the temperature it's supposed to be in?
Right. Absolutely. I mean, a lot of, you know, I think if you're a larger practice and you're connected to a hospital system, it might be easier for you to access like this kind of special freezer that you need. But no, I mean, if you're a smaller private practice, you're not just going to have this crazy cold freezer on hand ready to throw some Pfizer and Moderna vaccines in. So
does that follow that?
Coming back into play, yeah.
So sorry to interrupt you. Does it follow that, you know, the larger ones, meaning the urban centers, basically, will have mm-hmm. these capacities, and then rural doctor's offices that tend to be smaller will not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What have doctors said about this?
Yeah, I mean, they've said that this transition is a big lift for them. It's that storage. It's also the planning, and it's also all the administrative work that comes with registering patients into the state system and their own system. So, you know, for some smaller practices, it might not make sense for them to distribute the vaccine, at least not right now.
Well, back up a little bit and tell us why the state is doing this in the first place. Are the big state-sponsored vaccination yeah. sites not working as well? Are they not serving as many people? Well, what's the rationale behind this?
Yeah, I think the rationale behind this is, you know, getting vaccines into doctors' offices is a key strategy for trying to reach folks who, for whatever reason, may not have gotten a shot yet. And, you know, there's a few reasons for that. One is so many of us are really used to getting a vaccine at our doctor's offices. And so it's kind of a familiar place for people to get vaccinated. And bringing the vaccine into doctors' offices can really kind of tap into relationships that people have with their doctors. So if they've got questions or concerns, they can really talk those out with their doctor. And a lot of experts have said, you know, people trust the information around the COVID-19 vaccine when it's coming from their doctor a lot more than they might if it's coming from the state or a politician.
Okay. Well, before we let you go, Allie, I do want to make sure we talk a little bit about the masks and social distancing and the guidelines, because the state has a different kind of take on what the CDC is recommending with respect to mask wearing and social distancing and crowds and being outside. How would you go about describing the differences between the state's policy and what the CDC is recommending?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what the CDC has said is that if you are fully vaccinated, in most situations, you do not have to wear a mask or social distance. And, you know, I think that's great guidance for if you are going to a friend's house for dinner and they're also fully vaccinated, you know, the two of you, yeah, don't worry about wearing your mask. But when we're talking about a situation like a grocery store, for example, it's not like these grocery stores are going to sit there and ask every single person, hey, are you fully vaccinated or not? So kind of on a practical level, it's still going to make the most sense for just everyone to keep wearing their masks. And so what the state is recommending is, at least right now, that everyone keep on wearing their mask, keep on social distancing when they're in kind of a crowded indoor public setting.
Okay. And so as you continue reporting on this, Allie, what will you be looking at carefully with respect to COVID-19 and masks and the way we live our lives during the waning days of this pandemic?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm going to be looking out for the kind of how businesses are trying to implement and balance the CDC guidance with the state's recommendation to keep their customers both kind of satisfied and also safe.
All right. Well, NHPR's Allie Pham, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Peter. It was great to talk to you.
And of course, I refer to the COVID-19 pandemic and these days as the waning days, but we could only hope that it is the waning days of the pandemic. After a break, listeners, we're going to talk a little bit about efforts to change the way police do business here in New Hampshire. We'll talk with NHPR's Mary McIntyre about a variety of efforts stemming from the Lee Act Commission. We'll talk about what that is, what they recommended, and where those policy suggestions stand so far. And we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. What do you think about body cams for police officers? What about data collection? Did you testify at the state legislature? How did you feel? Again, our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. I'm Peter Biello. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We'll be right back. Monday on The Exchange, we talk with psychologist Christine Runyon about how living in a pandemic has impacted our minds and our bodies, and how that is playing out in our lives as we return to a more normal routine. That's Monday on The Exchange, live at 9 on NHPR. But right now, we're focusing on changes to the way the police do their jobs in New Hampshire. I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Thank you so much for tuning in. The legislature has taken on police reform this year after a Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community, and Transparency, known as the LEACT Commission, gave a list of recommendations for improving policing in New Hampshire. We'd love to hear from you on any and all of these policies. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. You can also email us. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. And with us now is Mary McIntyre, reporter and editor of NHPR's Morning Edition. She covers law enforcement as well. Mary, welcome to the program.
Hi, Peter.
So Mary, the Commission on Law Enforcement Accountability, Community, and Transparency, known as LEACT, gave a number of recommendations to the state on police reform, many of which were taken up in the legislature. And I want to start with the biggest piece of legislation, that's Senate Bill 96, also known as the LEACT Omnibus. What were some of the major things it was addressing when it was first proposed?
Sure. So that was first introduced way early on, back in January at the beginning of the session. And some of those proposals when it was first introduced included establishing a fund to encourage police agencies to purchase body and dash cameras, adding an option to include race and ethnicity on state IDs, and requiring police agencies to collect demographic data, including race. And then it would also require judges to receive training on implicit bias and racial profiling annually. And, you know, some of those proposals have been amended or taken out of the bill at this point, but that's how it was originally introduced.
Okay, so where is it possible to talk about those individually, or are they all kind of bundled together permanently in Senate Bill 96?
Sure. So we could break it down and talk about them individually. You know, starting with body cams, the body cam fund has stayed in the bill throughout the legislative session, and it would create a grant program that would allow police agencies to apply for funding in order to purchase body cams. As it stands, it would cover up to half the cost for purchasing that equipment or replacing that equipment.
Would local agencies have to match the other half?
I don't think so. No, it's kind of like a grant program that would be funded through the state. So yes, actually, yes. Your local municipality or department would have to cover the other half of the cost to be able to purchase those. And you know, as far as whether it would help encourage police departments to purchase more body cams, it's kind of mixed. You know, smaller departments, they've mostly been concerned when looking into purchasing body cams because it is very expensive. Mm-hmm. And those costs go way beyond just the initial purchase of the equipment. So administrative costs, data storage costs, those add up really quickly over time. And this body camera fund wouldn't help with those necessarily, but it would help with the initial purchase of the equipment.
Okay, so there's the body cam part. The data collection part, now there seems like there's two parts there. One is to add a section on the state ID for race or ethnicity, and then the requirement that police track those data points when they make a traffic stop, for example.
Right. So the LEAC Commission originally recommended that police agencies collect, like I said, demographic data, including race, for all encounters with the public, like traffic stops, for example. And to make it easier on police officers to collect that data, the commission also recommended that the DMV allow an option for people to put their race or ethnicity on state IDs, like driver's licenses. So that was part of the original LEAC omnibus bill, but it was stripped down a bit in the Senate. So Senate Republicans were concerned about including race on driver's licenses, and they did cite some concerns possibly from the DMV that, you know, there might not be room on the current layout for those IDs to include race. So they amended it so that the bill would instead establish a study commission to continue looking into this idea. And, you know, several LEAC members, they weren't very happy about that, to be honest.
Putting it into a study committee?
Right. I mean, the argument was, you know, that they had already met last summer for 2 months and studied this and talked about it before making the recommendation.
And because study committees are sometimes a way to just quietly dispose of a particular proposal.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. And delay something that could potentially help with transparency. So, you know, they were pushing for the state to put that data collection requirement back in the bill for the House when it went through the House. But this week, the House Judiciary Committee voted against an amendment that would have put that back in the bill. So as it stands, it would still only be a study committee.
I see. Okay. Did you hear of any feedback from police departments about data collection?
Yeah, so it was mixed. There were some police chiefs who testified in support of it, saying that, you know, their department would be able to handle collecting that data and that it was good for transparency. And then, you know, throughout this legislative session, there were other police chiefs who, you know, saw it as maybe being a possible burden, that they didn't see a way to effectively collect that data with their current data collection systems in place. Mm-hmm. So it was a bit mixed.
I see. And I should back up and ask you if police departments weighed in at all on the body cam issue.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I would say throughout this legislative session, the majority of officers testifying were in support of the idea of using body cams and support of, you know, if some funding is better than any funding, so in support of this body cam fund. But like I said earlier, you know, for smaller departments, the costs still really add up, especially for those costs that go beyond the initial purchase of the equipment. So I think, you know, for smaller departments who have been looking into purchasing body cams for a while, this fund would definitely be helpful for that. But whether it will encourage more departments across the state to, you know, look into body cams, I'm not really so sure yet. I guess we'll have to see. So it really varies by department.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, if you have thoughts about these proposals, were you in support of them? Do you work for a law enforcement agency in New Hampshire? And if you're able to talk on the air about this, give us a call now. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email. Our address is exchange@nhpr.org. Mary McIntyre, what about implicit bias training? This was part of Senate Bill 96, but what was it specifically for?
Sure. So just going back to those LEAC recommendations again, you know, they did recommend that pretty much everybody involved in the criminal justice system receive implicit bias training annually. So that would include police, but also prosecutors, judges, public defenders. And so, you know, the Attorney General's office, they've moved to provide that training for their staff. And the New Hampshire Police Standards and Training Council, they oversee the state's police academy. They've updated their training requirements for police departments to include more implicit bias training annually. But in this bill, the way that it was originally introduced would have required that training for judges as well. You know, when it made its way through the Senate, that was changed to encourage that training for judges instead of requiring it.
What's behind that change?
I think the idea is that it should be up to the courts to decide, or the individual judges to decide. And then a House committee this week took it out of the bill entirely. So it's no longer a part of the bill to...
not even encouraging judges.
Not even encouraging judges. And the argument for that, I believe, was there were some concerns about whether it was constitutional or not to require or to encourage judges to receive that training. So it was that amendment was passed and it's no longer part of the bill.
I see. Okay. Now, with respect to the idea of qualified immunity, was that part of Senate Bill 96, or is that just a separate thing altogether?
Sure. So it was not originally part of Senate Bill 96. There was a separate House bill that was introduced earlier this session on qualified immunity, and that was struck down in committee. You know, this past week, as the House Judiciary Committee was looking at SB 96, you know, there were some Democrats who were proposing to add a qualified immunity amendment in the bill that would the goal would be to end qualified immunity for police. It didn't receive great support kind of across the board. There were even some LEAC members who testified against it. The LEAC Commission didn't make recommendations around qualified immunity. And from what I remember last summer, you know, it might have come up in conversations here and there, but it wasn't a main focus for them in their conversations. So there were some LEAC members who testified against the qualified immunity amendment, just worried about, you know, the bill not passing overall if it was included.
And just so everybody's on the same page, how are we defining qualified immunity here? Is it a tricky definition?
I think, you know, I'll be honest, just sitting in this House committee hearing this week and hearing how people kind of all across the board talked about qualified immunity, there still seems to be a lot of confusion on both sides about what that would really mean federally and on the state level. So, you know, there were this wasn't passed, but there were people who suggested maybe in the future that the legislature establish another study committee to look at qualified immunity.
I see. Okay. And there has been some discussion of the Lori list. Now, I don't want to get too deep down in the weeds about this, but remind us what the Lori list is.
Sure. So the Lori list is a list of officers in New Hampshire who have been found of different levels of misconduct. It doesn't necessarily mean criminal mischief, but that could be one reason why an officer is on the list. And it's referred to as the Lori list, but it's an exculpatory evidence list. And there, you know, one of the LEAC recommendations was to make that public because currently it is confidential. It's not accessible by the public. And one of the bills making its way through would make the Lori list public. And it also would make disciplinary hearings for police officers public. So the New Hampshire Standards and Training Council, they sometimes do have police disciplinary hearings on whether an officer should be stripped of their license or not. They're not currently open to the public, but part of that bill would also make them public. So that's also making its way through.
Okay. Is there any other change proposed to the way police do their jobs in New Hampshire that isn't part of Senate Bill 96 that we haven't talked about yet?
Yeah, I mean, there's a good long list of reforms that were proposed this session and that were struck down. Yeah, I mean, some of them, you know, were not based on LEAC recommendations. But, you know, some examples of those bills that were struck down pretty early on was, you know, one that would have required police agencies to use body cams. So SB 96 establishes a fund to help police agencies purchase body cams, but there's no statewide requirement in place, right? It's up to individual departments. So that requirement was struck down. Another one that would have banned police use of rubber bullets and tear gas. Another that would have prohibited no-knock warrants. You know, that's not an exhaustive list, but that's just a few of the proposals that, you know, were earlier on in this session.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you think? What is the likelihood that Senate Bill 96 is going to become law?
I mean, at this point, it definitely looks likely to pass. The House Judiciary Committee this week voted that the full House ought to pass it. And I believe they meet in early June, so it'll be up for a vote then. Governor Sununu's been very supportive of all of the LEACT recommendations all along, ever since that report came out last year. So I'm sure that he'll be in full support of it.
Well, NHPR's Mary McIntyre, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thanks, Peter.
And chatting with me in person. This is the first in-person interview I've done on the Roundup in I don't know how long.
Yes, it's nice to actually see your face.
It's great to see you. Listeners are still commenting on the topic we talked about a little bit earlier on the program, the nature of the economy and unemployment benefits. Katie wrote in to write to say, I've been trying to build back my business since the bottom fell out of it last March. One way I've been doing that is to improve the e-commerce functionality of my website to increase online sales of our training, newsletter, and publications. But without the additional unemployment funds that provide a more stability to our income stream, I can't continue to pay the local freelance website person I've been working with and will be cutting back hours for my contract editor. I will also be cutting back hours for other workers on my farm. So the ultimate effect will be the opposite of what the governor intended. That's the comment from Katie. Thank you very much for weighing in, Katie. Among New Hampshire businesses, New Hampshire restaurants are really struggling to hire people. And that's because the problems they face are older and more complicated than those problems in other industries. As NHPR's Todd Bookman reports, the pandemic is prompting some industry veterans to rethink how restaurant workers get paid.
For 67 years, Hart's Turkey Farm Restaurant has had one star item on its menu.
I make turkey in every way that you can imagine.
Sim Willie is third-generation owner of this Meredith institution.
Turkey piccata, turkey dinner, turkey croquettes, turkey nuggets.
Hart's is a big restaurant. At full capacity, it seats about 600 people.
You ever get sick of turkey?
I do not.
On a busy day, he's cooking and serving 140-pound turkeys. For that, you need a big staff. Willie has about 230 employees during the busy summer tourist season. But this year, the applicants just aren't showing up.
I'm approximately about 100 short on my staff this year at this point.
There's a shortage of workers across lots of sectors of the job market right now, and it's particularly intense for restaurants. Willie says he's lucky to get one applicant a week. So to try and attract people, he's bumping up wages.
You know, we used to start everyone around $12 an hour. We're now closer to that $15, $16 an hour, depending on the job.
There are a few reasons why Hart's is struggling to hire. One issue is housing. It's expensive to live in a tourist area like the Lakes region. There are demographic issues. Lots of retirees and second homeowners live in New Hampshire. Not a lot of young people who typically staff restaurants. Hart's in the past has used J-1 visas to bring over international workers, but those programs have been limited due to COVID. And the shortage has real consequences.
At some point in time, if we don't get more help, I will have to consider, do I close a day a week? Do I not open for lunch? Or different things like that, which I'd prefer not to do.
There's one other factor that lots of restaurateurs I spoke with say has been slowing down hiring, the additional $300 a week in unemployment benefits the federal government has been paying. Starting next month, Governor Chris Sununu is following other Republican governors in ending that program.
Employers are opening up faster than we even envisioned, and the need for that $300 incentive or opportunity for folks not to have to be at work, the need for that is drastically dwindling.
The argument is that with smaller benefits, workers will come off the sidelines. But that doesn't mean people will necessarily come back to the restaurant industry.
The pandemic definitely gave a lot of people a renewed perspective.
Lily Jan is a lecturer of food and beverage management at the Hotel School of Cornell University. She says restaurants have long struggled to hire enough staff. The pandemic only magnified it. Jan says when many of her industry friends got laid off last year during the shutdown, a lot of them decided to find new careers.
What did they tell you? What are some of the reasons they're giving for leaving the industry?
They had some time off to think about what they wanted to do and who they wanted to be and where they wanted to spend their time. And I think a lot of people were reflecting and saying, this isn't necessarily where I want to go back to.
In New Hampshire right now, there are about 5,000 fewer restaurant workers than there were pre-pandemic. It's unclear how many will come back. It's hard for servers to work on their feet all day for minimum wage, $3.27 an hour plus tips. Jan says service workers often feel undervalued.
These are people who are there for consumers and guests on their best days, for weddings and anniversaries and proposals, on their worst days, for funerals and commiserating job losses and things like that, on all of the days in between when life is too hectic and you just need to grab a pizza from somewhere. These are the people that are there for you in good times, in bad times, and stressful times. But yet somehow we think that they are only worth the literal minimum in compensation.
The challenge is restaurants are already running on thin margins. And if they pass on the cost of higher wages, customers may not want to pay more for that turkey sandwich. And remember, at Hearts in Meredith, Sim Willie has already boosted wages, but still isn't getting applicants.
You know, this is my family's business. This is our legacy, or my legacy now. And I just wanted to get through the pandemic. And then all of a sudden, I'm like, oh my goodness, we're going to get through it. And then one day we're going to open. And now I don't have a staff.
Not enough staff means not as many customers. And that's not something any restaurant wants to contemplate. Todd Bookman, NHPR News.
And you're listening to the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. Just a reminder that next Wednesday on The Exchange, we're checking in with four members of the LEACT Commission we were discussing earlier. Those are folks who we spoke with last summer shortly after their recommendations came out. We're going to hear what they think about how the state has acted on calls for changes to policing in New Hampshire 1 year later. Coming up after a quick break, how has the recent state Supreme Court decision on ER boarding changed the discussion of the state budget? Has it at all? And what else is coming down the pike with respect to the state budget? NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers will join us, and your questions are welcome. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email exchange at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you for tuning in. Lawmakers in New Hampshire are crafting the state's next 2 year spending plan. And for some insight into how that's going, let's turn to NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers. Hey, Josh.
Good morning, Peter.
And listeners, if you have questions about the budget, now's the time to call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Josh, give us a kind of you are here on the map of the state budget. What parts of the process have we already completed? Where are we now and what's yet to come?
Well, the governor presented his budget. That package spent $13.6 billion. The House then completed its work on the budget. Their plan changed the governor's proposal. As typical, the House often sort of discards a lot of what any governor proposes. They trimmed spending out, so their budget came in around $13.5 billion, and you know, also tacked some non-budgetary items into House Bill 2. That's the trailer bill that puts the spending plan into law. Some of those are controversial, as I'm sure we'll discuss. The budget then cleared the House, moved on to the Senate. The Senate has been holding hearings and holding work sessions and are now, you know, kind of sharpening their pencils and are going to figure out how much money they believe the state has to spend and where that money ought to be spent. And, you know, in the middle of that, we've also had the arrival of the first tranche of money out of the American Rescue Plan. The state is going to be getting $1 billion over the next 2 years. And my understanding is about $500 million of that has arrived. And so that money combined with, you know, pretty rosy revenue situation, the state tax collections are up, has created a situation where, you know, there's a lot of money, decisions on how to spend a lot of money are going to be made in the budget and also perhaps outside the budget process in terms of the federal aid.
Okay. And as far as I understand, Josh, the Senate has a little better sense of how much money there actually is to spend, in part because tax revenue numbers come in by the time the Senate
exactly
has the bill. So has the Senate accounted for those either, I believe it's an increase in revenue from business taxes and whatnot, but also has it accounted for the money coming from the federal government?
Well, I mean, they know the money's out there. It's still a question of you know, how to spend the money. And, you know, that it is traditional that the Senate, by dint of late spring months being big revenue months for the state, it gives them a better sense of how much money the state will have to spend. It's not uncommon for the Senate to add funding to a spending plan. You know, I think everyone's grappling with the question of, you know, how best to use the federal dollars to, you know, there are 151 pages of guidance for the federal government about how that money can be used. Certainly, mental health is one area that has gotten a lot of talk. Infrastructure, certainly an approved use, things like broadband, water and sewer projects. And so I think that, you know, what the Senate budget writers are trying to do is make choices that will allow them, you know, sort of flexibility to use this federal money to try to not, you know, double spend and to, you know, try to ensure that, you know, in their estimation, the needs of the state are met while also passing the tax cuts that have been a priority for Republicans. And those tax cuts are going to be in the Senate plan as well as they were in the House. Tax cuts to businesses, to the phase out of the interest and dividends tax.
All right. Well, you mentioned mental health. So I did want to ask about what impact, if any, the state Supreme Court's decision on ER boarding will have on the budget. What's your perspective?
Well, I think it's definitely added some urgency. I mean, Governor Sununu came out and said, you know, we need to act in light of this ruling. This is not a new issue. You know, but you have the governor saying, you know, we have a broken system. This is something he said in the past, and, you know, Democrats have said that, you know, perhaps he hasn't moved as aggressively as his rhetoric has suggested. He has issued an executive order giving top state health officials a bit of a freer hand. And, you know, I certainly think as the budget moves out of the Senate Finance Committee, we are going to see, at least the goal is to see a plan for the long term on mental health. And then the question will be, you know, how is that going to be spent? How's the money going to be spent with state money? How are you going to utilize the federal aid? Senate President Chuck Morris indicated earlier this week that he's essentially expecting top state officials in the Department of Health and Human Services to present a plan spelling out their perceived, their perception of what's needed, and that then, you know, budget writers will start to make some decisions, and that federal aid might be directed in this apportioned for mental health, you know, later in the summer outside the budget process. But this is definitely going to be a big bunch of decisions that policymakers are going to be making in the budget and then later in the summer.
Josh, to this point, Andy wrote us a note about the mental health situation in New Hampshire. He says it should be noted that the state's quote-unquote solution has been to clear existing bed space by financially incentivizing other providers to accept these Medicaid patients from the state hospital, more than $40,000 per patient. In other words, they acknowledge that paying less than the cost of care causes that system to break down. Josh, to what extent are Andy's comments here discussed in the State House among lawmakers concerned with addressing the mental health crisis in the state?
Well, the state has it's been a struggle for the state to collect more, to create more beds. I mean, it's definitely true that through the years, you know, sort of post deinstitutionalization, the state has sort of stepped away a bit from providing those beds itself. Hospitals, meanwhile, have shed capacity in mental health beds for years. I mean, there are business considerations to some extent. There's, you know, less money in serving mental health patients and other things. You know, hospitals would argue that insurers haven't often met mental health parity and that that's been a problem. You know, Governor Sununu has in the past emphasized the need for what, you know, he's referred to as a nimble system, one that can intervene, you know, at the community mental health center level or with mobile crisis units, as well as creating some sort of designated receiving facility beds. But, you know, the state has really struggled, and, you know, it kind of depends on how you want to look at it. It's either some would say that the state's dragged its feet in getting a system up and running when the need was clearly there. You know, it's also struggled to hire the workforce it needs to create that system. And so, you know, what one thing that is definitely different now is that the ready supply of cash coming from the federal government, you know, and as I mentioned, revenues are way up. So, you know, there is money to be spent, and you know, bolstering the system, including maybe, you know, doing something, for instance, like building a new secure psychiatric unit. That's something that's people have talked about for years and never done. It strikes a lot of lawmakers as good sense in this moment. And, you know, as far as the governor goes, there's also, you know, kind of legacy questions for an ambitious politician. He's, you know, loudly said that the system is broken, and, you know, he's now been governor. He's been in there for a while, and I think he generally wants to improve the provision of mental health services, and people are going to be watching, you know, how he's managed or solved or not solved this problem, you know, as he potentially decides to run for federal office or another term.
So it seems like what I'm hearing, Josh, is that there's a lot of interest on both sides of the aisle to do something about mental health in New Hampshire. The question is, like, what? And there's not necessarily an agreement on what needs to be done right away.
Well, I think it's a complicated issue, and I think that serious people are taking serious looks at it at this time, and I think this is going to be something to watch in the budget process. And as I mentioned, later in the summer, I mean, the state has gained $500 million this year, $500 million next year. You know, it sounds like a cliche, but it certainly took the state a while to get into the situation. We've been in this situation, which is fairly acute, for a while, and I don't think people are necessarily expecting this is going to be immediately, you know, turn on a dime, but I think there's going to be significant spending or investment, depending on how you want to look at it, in this area.
Josh, we got this note from Eric in Hancock, who wanted to know, what's the latest with HB 544, the Trump-inspired bill aimed at stifling discussion of divisive concepts such as racial injustice and sex discrimination by any entities that receive state funding? It's been wrapped into the state budget, but what are the chances that this terribly misguided bill will become law? That's the comment from Eric in Hancock.
Well, you know, Eric may believe, as many others do, that this is a terribly misguided bill. Governor Sununu is among them, but this is something that is also very important to Republicans in the House. They say this bill has been sort of miscast. They put it in their budget. They considered this week actually tacking it into onto another bill. You know, what happens in the Senate is unclear at this point. Senate President Morris has said he could be open to supporting some of this. For lots of Republicans and voters who elect Republicans, this is an important issue. And for, you know, it's sort of broken down on party lines. Lots of Democrats and Democratic-leaning voters, this is a loathsome issue. One thing that will be interesting to see as this moves forward is how much of the discussion is about, you know, how such a policy would actually work if it becomes law. That's something that, like, you know, despite hours and hours of testimony and lots of public debate and discussion, including on NHPR, there's been very little discussion about the practical implications of this on the ground. You know, at a minimum, it strikes me it could make for some pretty fraught school board meetings. You know, we'll see how Governor Sununu handles this. This is kind of a delicate situation for him. He's gone out there and said that he would veto this bill. You know, is he going to veto a budget over it? I don't know. What form will it stay in the budget? Is it going to get stripped out? And if it got stripped out in the Senate, would that lead to impasse with the House? These are all questions that nobody really has an answer to at this point.
And Josh, you mentioned that lawmakers tried to append it to another bill.
Well, that was a discussion in the House Education Committee. They didn't, but you know, the fact that there was a discussion of trying to find other ways to keep this concept alive is certainly a measure of that it is a priority for leaders in the New Hampshire House.
Mm-hmm. The New Hampshire House also put language in its spending plan to require entities that provide state-funded family planning to keep their health care services separate, quote, financially and physically, from any services related to abortion. What's this about?
Well, I mean, this is a, you know, essentially, I don't know, you could fairly say it's something targeting Planned Parenthood and other medical service providers who both provide abortion services and non-abortion services such as cancer screenings, family planning, and the like. And, you know, Republicans have said, and people who oppose abortion, that essentially they made the argument that, like, money is fungible and that, you know, you put money, you send state money to, you know, a health clinic that provides abortions but also provides family planning, whether or not the money is sequestered in bank accounts that essentially, you know, taxpayer dollars are going to subsidize infrastructure that helps provide abortions, and that they consider that inappropriate. And so You know, the practical implications of this prohibition are that, you know, according to critics of it, is that a lot of women will miss out on health care. And so this is language that was stuck into the House budget. This has been debated a bit in the Senate. The Democrats on the Senate Finance Committee introduced language to strip that provision, which was rejected on party lines. But there was insinuation that there will be new language potentially addressing that, maybe presented as early as today. You know, the fate of that is unknowable at this point. But again, this is an issue. There were a bunch of these, you know, arguably in sort of non-budgetary policy matters tucked into the budget in the House explicitly to appeal to conservative members of the caucus. And, you know, some of these this is, again, going to be a delicate thing. And we'll see what happens in the Senate because, you know, nobody wants an impasse, you know, kind of a Republican. I mean, Republicans don't want a Republican on Republican kind of impasse on the budget. But, you know, it's going to take some delicacy to handle this by Republicans. And certainly, you know, Democrats are loudly opposed to this. And you know, this is these are not provisions that have been traditional in New Hampshire budgets.
Well, NHPR senior political reporter Josh Rogers, thank you very much for being on the program today.
Talk to you later, Peter.
Just a few notes on some stories that NHPR has been following. The state Senate has killed a bill that would have banned the construction of landfills within 2 miles of state parks. It had passed the House of Representatives with broad public support, especially from neighbors of a proposed landfill in the North Country. Waste management company Casella is proposing a new landfill in the town of Dalton, just next to Forest Lake State Park. The bill would have effectively killed the project. Republicans, who mostly voted against it, saw that as an infringement on landowner rights. They argue the park is protected by other state rules. And a New Hampshire House committee has voted along party lines for a proposal that Republicans and top state election officials hope will blunt a sweeping federal election bill now pending in the U.S. Senate. The bill asserts that New Hampshire will retain its full force and effect over elections for state offices, even if the federal bill becomes law. Democrats on the committee say the federal bill will expand voting rights by, among other things, outlawing photo ID requirements for voting and limiting partisan gerrymandering. And that's it for this week. But remember, the stories we discussed on the program today are at our website, nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's show was produced by senior Exchange producer Christina Phillips. Our producers include Jessica Hunt and Jane Vaughn. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. And I'm Peter Biello. Thank you so much for listening and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.